I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. Last night, the Maryland General Assembly wrapped up its 437th annual session, passing hundreds of bills in the final hours of sine die, as the last day is known. Governor Hogan was generally pleased with the session, but he has promised to veto a bill requiring employers to provide paid sick leave, citing concerns about the cost of the mandate. We'll talk about it with House Minority Leader Nick Kipke, who joins me from Annapolis. Then we'll talk with a panel of nonprofit leaders to find out how children, families, and some of our most marginalized citizens will be affected by this year's legislation. Charlie Carter of Maryland Working Families, Michael Wilson of Maryland Hunger Solutions, and Elizabeth Sachs of the Jobs Opportunities Task Force, they join me today on Midday. First, the news. And good afternoon and welcome to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Very glad that you've chosen to join us this afternoon. Last night at midnight, the 2017 General Assembly came to a close. Republican Governor Larry Hogan pronounced himself pleased overall. 2,681 bills were introduced over the last 3 months. Hundreds were passed yesterday on sine die, many of which will be signed today at a ceremony in Annapolis that is taking place at this hour. Tomorrow on Midday, reporters Rachel Bay of WIPR and Aaron Cox of the Baltimore Sun will join me to recap what bills made it and what bills didn't. We'll also talk with Democrat Delegate Nick Mosby and get his impressions of his first session as a state legislator. He was appointed to fill a vacant seat early in the session, and we'll also get the perspective of a Republican lawmaker. Today, we'll take a look at the session through the prism of legislation that affects children, families, and some of Maryland's most marginalized citizens. One of the most contentious battles this session was over paid sick leave. Governor Hogan proposed a bill that would have required businesses that employ 50 or more workers in a single location to provide sick leave. Democrats rejected that bill in favor of a bill that requires businesses with 15 or more full-time employees to provide employees the opportunity to earn at least 5 sick days a year. That's the bill that has landed on Governor Hogan's desk. He has threatened a veto. Later in the program, we'll hear from some nonprofit experts who say paid sick leave is a big win for the working poor and single and working families in Maryland. But first, Nicholas Kipke represents Anne Arundel County in the Maryland House of Delegates, and he joins us by the phone from Annapolis. Delegate, welcome to the program. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
I know you had a late night last night and a busy day today. Talk about why you were opposed to the bill that eventually passed the legislature regarding paid sick leave.
Well, for the record, I don't think anybody in the General Assembly is opposed to paid sick leave. You know, I think it's something that all of us think is, important that people have the ability when they're sick to not go to work. I mean, it's just it's common sense that in any environment that you're in, you don't want people around you who are sick working with you. And, you know, whether it's a restaurant, a store, a business, I think we all agree about that. The governor introduced legislation that would have provided paid sick leave benefits for everybody. And he just did it in a way that took into account the very real concerns of small mom-and-pop businesses throughout our state, whether they're Main Street stores, mom-and-pop restaurants, you know, small enterprises that operate usually on a very thin profit margin. He wants to provide them with tax credits, incentives to participate in this. And we just think that that would have been a more sensible way of providing this benefit to Marylanders without the possibility of doing the harm that may exist in a package like this, where these small entrepreneurs may not be able to survive with the added cost that this bill is going to require.
But isn't it also the case, sir, that had Governor Hogan's bill passed, it would have covered far fewer people?
Well, the bill that passed doesn't cover people from 1 to 15. So if an employer, a small retailer or restaurant or many other, people want this bill, I think, primarily for these types of environments. And the bill doesn't cover any of those environments that passed the General Assembly. So if you work for a small employer right now, you can't get covered unless they voluntarily do it. Governor Hogan's bill would have created an incentive. It didn't require them to do it, but they'd be foolish not to. They would have received a tax incentive to offer the benefit to their employees. And therefore, we believe it would have covered a far greater pool of people than the bill that passed today. And it would have, something that also has to be considered is, in many environments, whether it's a retail shop or a restaurant or other, there's a, in these part-time environments, there's a process called shift swapping, where if you can't show up because you're sick or you have some other obligation, you get somebody else on the schedule to cover your shift. And that's how these folks, that's the standard operating practice. And, they would, this bill prevents that from taking place anymore. And so, it's just, we're worried about the unintended consequences. We're seeing already in many of these environments where unemployment, where people are actually losing their jobs. There's fewer hostesses, there's fewer entry-line workers, because people are realizing they need to cut costs. And these types of bills run up the cost, and as a result, limit the number of entry-line workers in our small employment market.
The governor has indicated that he's inclined to veto the bill that did pass, the Democratic version of the bill. Can you give us the latest on that? Is that still his position as far as you know?
Well, I haven't spoken with the governor, so I don't, about this topic. I saw him this morning. A lot of good happened this session, a lot of bipartisan work. He led on a lot of very important issues that he gained the support of the Democratic legislature on. But I don't know where his mindset is on this. The Senate did amend it to make it a little better for the small employers in our state. I would tell you there was a lot of concern, even among Democrats in the legislature, that this bill was going too far and the unintended consequences. The bill wants to do some really good things for people, but we have to make sure that the cost of it isn't so great that it drives some people out of business. And there were a lot of folks who came to us, whether it was from Ocean City or, Garrett County or in the center of the state, where all the, Anne Arundel County, for example, we had mobs of people come down here saying, look, we just can't afford to offer this benefit. Please don't do this to us. Let's do the tax credit instead. That's a more sensible approach, I believe. This is the most aggressive mandated paid sick leave policy in the country. And it was being pushed, largely up, that is sort of out there, by union money, who exempted themselves from the bill. So if you work for a union, no aspect of this bill applies to you at all. So, there's a lot of issues with it. I think we need to, I hope the governor vetoes it. I hope we take another look at it, come up with a more sensible approach.
You're the minority leader in the House of Delegates. You are used to counting votes. If the governor does veto it, what do you give its chances of the legislature overriding that veto?
I think it'll be very close. I think we need four more Democrats to join us. There were Democrats who voted against this bill, I'll point out. And what all of them have in common is they've worked in private enterprise that would be considered a small employer. They understand how difficult it is to make ends meet. I think there's some other votes there that we'll be able to win over between now and next year. I'm already hearing from people, now that this bill has passed, that I didn't hear from before, expressing great concern about their ability to somehow figure out a way to absorb the additional costs that this benefit will provide. And remember, this benefit isn't just for the sympathetic individuals that we all want to help. It's also for entry level workers, young employees, their first job, that they're just trying to make a few extra bucks. This is not just for people who are using this type of employment to pay their rent, pay their mortgage, pay their bills, put food on the table. This bill goes too far, and as a result, it's going to have the unintended consequence, if it's enacted ultimately, of reducing job opportunities in the state of Maryland, primarily for entry-level workers.
Delegate, I know you're busy and you've got to go, but let me just ask you one general question. What's your overall impression of the session this year? The governor seemed pretty pleased, generally speaking. How about you?
Well, I was just with the Senate president, the Speaker of the House, and the governor, and I think everybody now, the dust has settled, is looking at what happened and feels very positively about it. I mean, we passed one of the most robust opioid addiction packages in the country. Basically, nobody knows how to solve this problem that we're having in our communities as it relates to the addiction to heroin and that results from the opioid painkillers. But we threw everything out there, and we passed an enormous package of bills that's going to make, I believe, it'll be easier to get treatment in our communities. It's going to make it easier for folks to find help. And also, I think it's going to make it we're going to be more proactive and going to our schools, going into our colleges, talking to our young people in this state about the risks associated with it in an effective way. So I think we made some great progress there. There's a jobs bill that passed that everybody's rallying behind that we believe. I mean, I think it's guaranteed as because of the passage of the bill, it's going to bring in, tens of thousands of jobs over the next decade that wouldn't have happened otherwise. And, there's more. I feel like we came together around some bipartisan issues. The governor put in a very robust legislative package, and people got to work on it. And I'm pleased to see that for once in government, there's a great example of how Democrats and Republicans can put the people first, and I'm very proud to have been a part of it.
Delegate Nicholas Kipke is the House Minority Leader in the Maryland General Assembly. He represents Anne Arundel County in the House of Delegates, and he's joined us on the phone from Annapolis. Delegate, thank you so much, and we look forward to the next time. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
By the way, coming up tomorrow on the program, we're going to continue our coverage of Sine Die with perspectives on the 2017 General Assembly from Baltimore City Democratic Delegate Nick Mosby, as well as a Republican lawmaker. I'll also talk with WIPR's Rachel Bay and Aaron Cox of the Baltimore Sun. They'll give us a rundown of the major bills that passed this session and what they'll mean for Marylanders. Coming up after a break today, we're going to continue our conversation about what happened in this year's session with three leaders of nonprofits who work on behalf of children and families who often find it hard to make ends meet. In addition to the paid sick leave legislation, we'll examine some other bills that have had an impact or will have an impact on their constituents. Charlie Carter is the executive director of Maryland Working Families. Michael Wilson is the director of Maryland Hunger Solutions. Elizabeth Sachs is the executive director of the Jobs Opportunities Task Force. They'll join me here in Studio A when we come back. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
You're listening to Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. As we discussed before the break with Delegate Nick Kipke, who's the House Minority Leader in Annapolis, a bill requiring paid sick leave passed the General Assembly last week. Champions of the bill say that this is a major victory for single parents and working families. So we heard from Nick Kipke about his concerns about the legislation that passed. He did support the governor's plan for sick leave that would have required fewer employers to provide it, at least by some reckoning. Paid sick leave is among several bills that have been closely watched in this session of the General Assembly by my next guests this afternoon. Michael J. Wilson is the director of Maryland Hunger Solutions. Charlie Carter is the executive director of Maryland Working Families. And Elizabeth Sachs is the executive director of the Jobs Opportunities Task Force. Welcome to you all. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
And you are welcome to join us as well. Our number here on Midday, 410-662-8780. Would love to hear your impressions in this the early tabulation of what went down on Sine Die yesterday. They finished up in Annapolis about midnight. 410-662-8780. If you'd like to join our conversation, if you want to drop us an email, you can get us at midday@wypr.org, and you can send us a tweet at Midday Tom Hall. So, Charlie Carter, your impression of what happened in terms of this paid sick leave bill. I mean, it was a contentious battle. I think an original supporters of the bill were hoping for a 7-day window. It ended up being 5, a little compromise there. But your take on what happened.
I want to say that this bill has been 5 years in the making, for that there have been very deliberate negotiations and conversations working with advocates on behalf of families in the state and businesses who've come to the table in good faith to try to craft the strongest possible bill for Maryland. And this bill covers 750,000 low and moderate income workers and providing this critical benefit that creates stability, financial stability for families, and also levels the playing field. Let's be clear that there are millions of workers in this state that already enjoy this benefit. And so to hear Delegate Kipke say that this is something that's going to bankrupt business, there are already, you know, thousands of businesses who provide this to their employees, and they're still going strong, and we have a strong economy. So I don't think that extending this privilege to low wage workers is anything that's going to really disrupt our economy.
And Michael, I mean, do you know one way, or Elizabeth, maybe you know this as well. I was a little surprised by Delegate Kipke's assertion that Governor Hogan's bill, by his reckoning, may have covered more people, because Governor Hogan's bill said 50 employers or employees at a single location. So if you look at the normal, like McDonald's or Burger King, and you've got young people working on in those line jobs, I mean, they probably don't have 50 people at each location, so they would have been exempted. I mean, is there data that says one way or the other how this would have worked, Elizabeth Sachs?
Well, I think when you look at the governor's proposal, that 50-employee threshold was going to leave a lot of businesses exempt, because it wasn't just 50 at one location. It was 50 at all locations. And so, in fact, it would have meant if you had 50 in one place but 10, 10, and 10, nobody was probably going to be covered. So this is why we think that HB1, which is the bill that passed, really is the balanced approach. We are not the most aggressive legislation in the country. We're middle of the road. You pointed out some states have 7 days. The Senate looked at the bill, heard from industry, moved it down to 5. Our bill also takes into account shift swapping. It does allow it. So I think some of the things that were issues before were addressed, and the legislation that's passed and that is on the governor's desk is the common sense approach on this issue.
And Michael J. Wilson, I mean, has this been, are you hearing from your constituents, for example, that this has really been a very difficult issue to contend with? Because if you take a day off from work and you don't get paid, that's a serious hit to a family budget that doesn't start with a whole lot to work with.
Right. So people who are experiencing poverty always have challenges more than the rest of us. So missing a day of work or potentially losing your job because you can't get to work because you're sick or you've got a sick kid is really, really a challenge. And so we think this bill is the right approach to address poverty in general in our state, and it's going to be very helpful.
It just shows once again how expensive it is to be poor.
Yep.
You know, exactly. I mean, there's just so many costs associated with being poor that people who aren't poor don't have to, you know, everything from cashing a check to taking a day off from work. I mean, really, it's something. Charlie Carter, you watch this game quite closely. The governor has indicated he may veto the legislation. It passed with veto-proof majorities in both the House and the Senate. If you were a betting woman, would you put your money on the House and the Senate being able to override a veto if it comes?
Well, our hope is that Governor Hogan sees the common sense in just allowing this bill to become law. He himself has been, had to experience taking time away from work, and he was fortunate enough not to have his pay impacted. And we, you know, really believe that what he said earlier when he announced his own bill is that, you know, sick leave, being able to take time off from work when you're sick, is a public health issue as well as a financial issue for families. So I would like to believe that he's going to allow this law to become, this bill to become law without his signature. But if he decides to play politics with people's lives and livelihoods, I do believe that we have the votes to override his veto.
Mm-hmm. And Michael and Elizabeth, you all come to the same addition?
Yes. I mean, I'll say that the coalition, the Working Matters Coalition, of which many groups, including the Working Families, Public Justice Center, Advocates for Children and Youth, and many, many more faith, labor, and parents organizations have supported this bill. And they are continuing to ask the governor to please let it become law. We had tremendous support this session, and we will continue to let people know that this bill deserves to become law so people can get the benefit of it.
That's Elizabeth Sachs. She's the executive director of the Jobs Opportunities Task Force. Charlie Carter's here as well. She's the executive director of Maryland Working Families. And Michael J. Wilson joins us as well here in Studio A. He is the director of Maryland Hunger Solutions. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. If you'd like to join our conversation about paid sick leave, about what you know of what's come down in Annapolis in this year's edition of the General Assembly, you're welcome to give us a call, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle @MiddayTomHall. So, Michael, there's been a couple. There were a couple of other things past this session that are of particular interest to you. One is called the Equal Access to Food Act. What's that about?
Right. So when we look at the General Assembly, unlike Delegate Kipke, it really is a story of the glass being half empty. It really is. So one of the good things is the Equal Access to Food Act. There is a law in Maryland where people who are former convicted drug felons who serve their time and return to the community are barred from getting food stamps. It's a remnant of the old Welfare Act and drug wars of the 1990s, and most states have gotten rid of this, but Maryland still has a partial bar. And we believe it's not helpful to have people who are returning to the community have to struggle for food. We want them to be able to be a part of the community. We work very closely with the Job Opportunities Task Force and with Out for Justice and others to try to move this. And so this did pass the legislature, and we're hopeful that it will become law.
Mm-hmm. And just recently, a legislature also passed to allow former felons to vote, for example.
That's
so,
exactly
I mean,
right.
There seems to be a movement towards, you know, greater incorporation of, you know, formerly incarcerated people into society.
I think there's a recognition that people who have served their time, who are coming back to the community, need to be mainstream, need to be part of the community, should not be stigmatized or further penalized after incarceration. I think both of these moves are moves in a good direction.
Yeah, of course, and a lot of folks make the economic argument about it as well. It's not just a moral argument that, you know, if someone's got food insecurity or housing insecurity, can't find a job because of a prior conviction, what's that person going to do? You know, how's that person going to be part of
That's exactly right.
our society? Yeah. Elizabeth, were there particular pieces of legislation very much on your radar? I mean, I know you're very involved in the paid sick leave bill, but what else caught your notice?
Well, just following from the comment a minute ago, one of the bills that we're thrilled passed is a bill that would ban the question about criminal records on college applications. We heard very moving testimony from individuals who indeed felt intimidated by having that question on a college application. And of course, access to higher education is a proven strategy for improving your family's earning power. So this bill would require our colleges and universities to be clear that a criminal record is not a prohibition to admission, and also let students know if that information should become obvious, what they're going to do with it, how they're going to balance it. And so we are very pleased that the higher education community and the legislature recognized that this was a very important change that needed to be made so that criminal records are not a barrier to higher education.
And we should be clear that this legislation doesn't say that this information that a person has been incarcerated is never revealed.
Correct.
But it's revealed at a different point in the process, very similar to the Ban the Box legislation that Nick Mosby introduced a couple years ago in the city council in terms of employment. I mean, at some point, the employer, or in this case, the institution of higher education,
yes,
is going to know about this, but it's going to be at a point further in the process than heretofore.
That's correct. And it also doesn't serve as a deterrent. When you're filling out an application and that's the first thing you see, some people would say, okay, this is not going to be for me. Why bother? And this way, they can put their academic and other assets on the table and be considered without that being a barrier to their own pursuit.
And Charlie Carter, I mean, for example, the Ban the Box legislation that's now been in place for a couple of years, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Is there data now? I mean, are you hearing from folks who are employers, for example, the Ban the Box legislation having to do with employment? Do we have some early indications of how that's working, whether or not that's an extra burden on the employers? We heard that that was going to be part of the issue. We heard that it was going to cost them a lot of money to, you know, figure this out later in the process. What do we know about that legislation now, that while it's still kind of in its nascent form?
Well, I think Elizabeth could probably speak better on this issue, but we talk a lot to families of returning citizens, and we should remember that when we had this war, the war on drugs, it devastated entire communities and families and caused immense financial instability and poverty, increased poverty. And so to have people coming out of the penal system and being able to return to work without extreme barriers, that we've seen families start to recover. And Elizabeth might be able to cite statistics, but, you know, on the ground, what's important is being able to have two parents who are working in a household, and even if they're working more than one job, to provide some kind of financial stability to that family.
Mm-hmm. And as those families become more stabilized, entire neighborhoods become more stabilized, because there are some neighborhoods and communities of color in this town in which, you know, an enormous percentage of homes are affected by people who are incarcerated.
So, yeah, I mean, the Job Opportunities Task Force, we look a lot at what are barriers to employment. And when an arrest, let alone serving time, becomes a barrier and it gets in the way of food stamps and it gets in the way of higher education and it gets in the way of driver's licenses and driver's insurance, it really sets you back yet again. And so that's why we work every year on legislation that tries to remove those barriers. It happens to be one at a time, but we've been doing it for many years. And it does seem that finally, as Michael said, there's beginning to be a recognition that we have to help people get ahead by making sure barriers aren't there because they've served time or merely had it for an arrest record.
It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you'd like to join our conversation, our number 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle @MiddayTomHall. I'm joined here in the studio by Michael J. Wilson of Maryland Hunger Solutions, Charlie Carter of Maryland Working Families, and Elizabeth Sachs of Jobs Opportunity Task Force. Again, 410-662-8780 if you want to be part of our conversation here about what's just come down in this 437th edition of the Maryland General Assembly. One other thing about higher education, a bill passed providing tuition waivers for kids who were in foster care or if they're homeless youth. I mean, Charlie Carter, this is another barrier for kids who, you know, who have had housing insecurity and family insecurity for sometimes most of their lives. They get out of high school, they get through, they get, you know, they manage to graduate, which is terrific. And then the fun has just begun for them, hasn't it?
You know, this is a real win. I think our state, to its credit, and our legislature, to its credit, has continued to make remove obstacles for children who've been in the foster care system. And this is just the latest in making it easier and really providing a platform for them to launch a successful life. And so I really applaud the legislature for passing this bill. I do want to go back to something that Elizabeth just said. She mentioned removing barriers to success for formerly incarcerated people one at a time. And I think I do want to raise, while we've done a really good job of making financial gains and passing laws that create financial stability, there is still this attitude in Annapolis where we can only do one thing at a time. We, you know, the advocates know what the problems are. We spend a great deal of time talking to our general members of the General Assembly about what the issues are. So they know what the problems are, too. And I really think that what I would like to see in our legislature do is stop taking an approach where we can only do one thing at a time. We can walk and chew gum. This is Maryland, where the wealthiest state and the wealthiest nation and the wealthiest country at the wealthiest period in the history of the world. I think that we can take a broad approach to tackle problems to really create financial stability for the low and middle income families in Maryland and the children.
Yeah, and Michael J. Wilson, I mean, a lot of folks might point to, for example, the package of legislation having to do with opioid addiction, because right. It wasn't just one bill. It was a bunch of bills. And the governor said, you know, we've got to attack this problem in various different ways. not all the ways were ways that experts in this field agreed with. I mean, right. There's some stuff having to do with harsher penalties and that seems to be a kind of a throwback to an attitude or an approach, you know, from the 90s. But still, it is a package.
Right.
So is there, you know, in terms of the big sweep, the big broad, you know, all-encompassing kinds of legislation that would help people who've been marginalized, people who are facing challenges that many people don't have to face. What would you suggest?
So, you know, we've had a package of things that we've tried to deal with to try to address hunger here in the state of Maryland. Most folks don't know that in the state of Maryland, the farms rate, the free and reduced meals for kids, there are 44% of the kids in Maryland schools get either free or reduced meals. 44%. So it's almost half. And so while
and they get this, make sure folks understand, they get that because they qualify because of the income levels in their household.
That's exactly right. And so while it's true we have a very wealthy state, we also have poverty in every part of our state. And so we're trying to address that with, for example, the Hunger Free Schools Act, which I think we'll talk about, and also the Maryland Cares for Kids Act, because there are both macro and micro ways for us to make very smart, targeted investments in our most marginalized communities.
Going to take a little break in just a second, but let's first go to Sam in Annapolis. Take a call. Sam, welcome to Midday. Glad you called.
Thank you. I'd like to ask the panel how state efforts relate to federal efforts. There seems to be, with the new administration, an attempt to return to over-policing of certain communities with questioning of consent degree agreements and a desire to renew the war on drugs, which both of which lead to a pipeline of people into the prison system. It sounds to me like the state's going to be trying to empty the bathtub while the feds are filling it, and I wonder how that dynamic would be, especially if conditions about the criminality and drugs are put on federal dollars to the state. What's the dynamic? Can the state go forward with the initiatives you're talking about in the face of a federal government administration going in the opposite direction?
Well, thank you for your call, Sam. I appreciate it. So, Elizabeth Sachs, there were a package of bills passed to try to sort of, you know, guard against federal initiatives that the Trump administration might propose, having to do with Planned Parenthood and other things like that. But, of course, the specter of a Trump administration federal policy hangs high over every statehouse in the country, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. And it's certainly true that our legislative leadership this year was very careful to look at a few things and say we better almost make sure that things don't roll back in Maryland just because there may be actions, whether they're budgetary or policy-wise, at the federal level. But we also can't predict everything that's going to come down the pike. And I think what we saw this session was, you know, let's stay the course in what Maryland has done. Last year was a big effort with the Justice Reinvestment Act, and it's still to be implemented. And it looks at how do we change some of our criminal justice policies and reinvest those funds in many of the initiatives we've talked about here. And I'm not hearing that that's going to change at the state level. And I think at JOTF, we will advocate. We've got to stay the course and not let changes, especially around criminal justice and the policies that it sets up, get in the way of people's progress here in Maryland.
JOTF refers to the Jobs Opportunities Task Force. That's the thing that Elizabeth Sachs directs. Michael J. Wilson is the director of Maryland Hunger Solutions, and Charlie Carter is the executive director of Maryland Working Families. We'll have more with all of these folks here on our panel on the General Assembly when we return. 410-662-8780 is how you can join our conversation. Our email, midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. We're glad you're with us. Stick around.
This is your NPR news station, 88.1 WYPR.
And Welcome back to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, we're talking to three leaders in the nonprofit sector about the 2017 General Assembly, which concluded last night in Annapolis. We're going to talk more about the General Assembly with WIPR's Rachel Bay and the Baltimore Sun's Aaron Cox tomorrow on Midday. Today, we're concentrating on legislation that either passed or didn't pass, having to do with working families, children, and folks who are often marginalized here in Maryland. Charlie Carter is the Executive Director of Maryland Working Families. Michael J. Wilson is the Director of Maryland Hunger Solutions. And Elizabeth Sachs is the Executive Director of the Jobs Opportunities Task Force. You can join our conversation by calling 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. So, Charlie Carter, one of the pieces of legislation that passed had to do with Planned Parenthood. So I want to ask you about that vis-a-vis the Sam's call that we took before the break and the Trump administration and the threats to dismantle Planned Parenthood. What does the legislation here in Maryland say, and why do you think it's important?
Well, I'll start by saying 80% of families in the state of Maryland depend on a woman's wages. And there is no bigger factor in a woman being able to make a wage than her reproductive health and choosing when and if she's going to have children. And so the Family Planning Services Act will guarantee that low and middle income women who rely on Planned Parenthood for their reproductive health medical care will be able to continue to get services from that provider with having the funding, the state provide funding for those.
Another thing, Elizabeth Sachs, on the criminal justice arena is bail reform. A lot of talk about it. But it seems that it got stalled. Tell us what they were talking about and what actually happened as of midnight last night.
Well, from our perspective, we're actually thrilled at the outcome. Just dialing this back to last fall, Attorney General Frosch issued an opinion which questioned the legality of the state's bail system and said pretrial defendants should not be held just because they can't afford to pay bail. And as a result of that, the Maryland Court of Appeals issued a rule to ensure that cash bail, while it would be an option for judges, would be the least, they wouldn't be the first condition imposed for defendants who are in a flight risk, and also asking judges to consider whether the defendant can afford the bail. So all of that was on the table as we came into session, and there were attempts to block the court rule. And the good news from our perspective, we were part of the Coalition for a Safe and Just Maryland, is that the court rule will take effect so that judges will not jump to bail as the first option. They will also look at a defendant's ability to pay. And so we are very glad to say that we will be able to see this court rule take effect and see how it works going forward. And that's great for those that really can't always afford the bail that's been imposed in the past.
Yeah, we've done a couple of shows about that here on Midday, and it really is quite an interesting and sometimes outrageous situation. A person who's been charged with a crime but not gone to trial,
yes,
has bail imposed, and if he or she can't pay it, is incarcerated.
Right. Right.
You know, because so you know, you haven't been convicted of anything, and some of these people clearly are not flight risks, and they're losing their jobs, and you know, other things are happening.
Right, and just going to some of what we've discussed earlier, the disruption when you're thrown in jail, you don't have provisions. Who's going to take care of your children? You may lose your job. We offer in our work a job training program. You lose your training slot. There are many, many effects when you are thrown without having been found guilty into jail simply because you can't pay the bail.
Michael J. Wilson, let's go to the issue of food in the schools, the Hunger Free Schools Act. You alluded to it. Let's talk a little bit more about that, and also the Farms and Family Act.
Right. So the Hunger Free Schools Act is an extension of a bill that passed a couple of years ago, which enabled Baltimore City Public Schools, for example, to be able to serve free breakfast and free lunch to every student in the school system. That's also true in Somerset County, where they serve it countywide. That we had to do a tweak in the state law about the collection of farms forms so that they could participate in that federal program. And now it's spread throughout the state of Maryland. There are two schools in wealthy Howard County which are using it, two in Montgomery County. There are 9 in Prince George's County and 11 in Washington County. They're all over the state, and so this has been a really helpful effort. If I can touch on just for a second the other side of that coin, which is the Maryland Cares for Kids Act, in addition to that, we were trying to get the legislator to pick up the costs for reduced price kids around the state of Maryland. There are 45,000 of them who are therefore less likely to eat than kids getting free meals or paid meals, and also they're the ones that get the school bills. And those 45,000 kids, for example, are not in Baltimore City where they have community eligibility, or in Somerset, or any place where we have hunger-free schools, but they're in Anne Arundel County, they're in Prince George's County, they're all over the state from east to west. And for some reason, the legislature did not see fit to fund and pay for that bill, which is a real problem.
So let's make sure folks understand this clearly. There are some jurisdictions where every kid, regardless of economic status, gets free lunch at school?
That's right. There are two jurisdictions, and that's because of the high rates of free and reduced meals. In Baltimore City, for example, if you did applications, 85% of the kids would be eligible for free and reduced meals. And rather than go through all the rigmarole of passing out forms and chasing them down and
going through the lunch line, this kid qualifies, this kid does not.
That's exactly right. The administrative costs of that outweighed the reduction. And there's a federal program called Community Eligibility by which you, rather than do those individual forms and applications, you use a direct certification method and determine whether or not the school or group of schools or school system is eligible.
So the 45,000 children that you're talking about don't live here in Baltimore City.
That's correct. They may live in Allegheny County or Frederick County or on the Eastern Shore or any place, but those 45,000 kids are the kids who are in the reduced price category. And so if you're a mom making $25,000, which is not a lot of money, you're still going to have to pay a school meal bill.
And Charlie Carter, on the other end of the life spectrum, you supported a bill having to do with healthy aging. Tell us what happened with that.
Well, this bill expands the Department of Aging programs to encourage seniors to age in place, to actually stay in their homes instead of moving to assisted facilities. And this is, it's a much more economic, a cost-effective way of managing aging. It provides stability and allows the families to hang on to their wealth, which is their home. And in many cases, people are, seniors are forced to sell their homes in order to move into a senior home. This allows them to stay at home, provide support for family members who want to take care of them. And we think it's really kind of a step forward in the care of our aging population.
Let me ask you, Charlie, about alliances that have either been traditional and perhaps have attenuated a little bit, or new and unusual alliances that come up around legislation. I know you were very involved with your organization, Maryland Families, in the Port Covington decision. And you were, I think ultimately, if I recall correctly, you disapprove of the thing that was ultimately passed and accepted. There seemed at that point to be something of a tension between unions, for example, and people in the community, the activist community. Delegate Kipke took care to mention that the unions opposed this paid sick leave bill that we're going to exempt union members. I mean, is there a tension? Is there a problem between what has been a traditional progressive alliance between organizations like unions and activists who work with the folks that you're working with?
I disagree with Delegate Kipke. I think he should talk to more unions. What I can say is that the Healthy Working Families Act that passed was supported by more than 150 organizations, which included unions. And it was the top priority for many of organizations, from Catholic Charities to labor unions, to Working Families and Job Opportunities Task Force, and Maryland Hunger Solutions. So I think what we're seeing is, from my perspective, is an unprecedented coming together of different groups that traditionally don't work together. You're seeing, economic development advocates and transportation advocates coming together with working families and with labor unions to talk about the negative impact on our communities when we don't invest money in the right places, how we exacerbate the problem of poverty and hunger. For example, when we decide we're going to take, invest $660 million into, a wealthy enclave instead of actually trying to rebuild our existing communities and address issues in our schools.
What do you all make of the narrative that some people have about Governor Larry Hogan, who has, first of all, we should note, a 65% to 68% approval rating, depending on what poll you're looking at. This is his third session. He himself characterizes it as one of the most successful that he's had of the three that he's had. And next session, it's assumed, is going to be very much informed and colored by the fact that it's an election year in 2018. So there's a narrative that says that Governor Hogan is particularly hostile to the city of Baltimore. Instead of a red line, we have a revamped bus system. Instead of a development at State Center, which has been in the works for like 13 years, we're going back to the drawing board and starting from scratch, at least if the governor and the Board of Estimates has their way. I mean, Elizabeth, what do you think about Governor Hogan and his interest and his advocacy on the state's largest city?
I don't think he's hostile to the city of Baltimore. I think there are times when he recognizes the needs of the city. But I do think that it is a shift from what we're used to in Maryland, where we've had, several governors who were mayors of Baltimore. I know there's been some, the school funding, there was some money given. So, I think, it's just a shift that we all have to adjust to, both as advocates and as a city resident.
Michael J. Wilson?
So I think what the governor does and what the state legislature does often has to be seen through a political lens, because they are politicians and they are taking political actions whether or not it's an election year. The challenge for organizations like ours is to talk about the issues and the communities, whether they're in Baltimore or other places, and the needs of those communities, and to do so in a nonpartisan way. And regardless of the politics, we have issues that we have to address, that people need addressed, whether you live in Baltimore or whether you live in Prince George's County or on the Eastern Shore. And for us to not get caught in the politics of how popular someone is or unpopular they are, and to really talk about the issues that really need to be addressed.
Charlie mentioned that we live in one of the wealthiest states at one of the wealthiest times in the history of humankind.
Yeah.
Is the problem of hunger in Maryland, the problem of people who have deep-seated food insecurity, better, worse, the same than it was, say, 5 years ago?
For some people, it's better, and for some people, it's worse, and for some people, it is the same. And the challenge that we have to address hunger and poverty is partly a problem of political will, so that we need leadership that can actually address these issues. And it's partly a problem of the function of the state and the federal economy. So there's it's undoubtedly better for some
folks.
All right,
well, we need to leave it there. Michael J. Wilson is the director of Maryland Hunger Solutions. Charlie Carter is with the Maryland Working Families. And Elizabeth Sachs is the director of the Jobs Opportunities Task Force. We've got more information about what all of these folks do with their organizations at WIPR.org/Midday. That's it for us today. Coming up on the program tomorrow, we'll hear from a Democrat and a Republican member of the Maryland legislature with their impressions of what went down in Annapolis over the last 3 months, as well as WIPR's Rachel Bay and Aaron Cox of the Baltimore Sun. That's coming up tomorrow on Midday. Thank you all for being here this afternoon. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
I'd like to thank Joe Squared for providing lunch today. Joe Squared serves coal-fired pizzas, risotto, and local craft beers. Locations and hours at joesquared.com. Thanks for listening to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Have a great day.